books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today I'll be chatting to author Charlotte Butterfield about her brand new book, The Sister Switch. Plus, as always, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On.
Charlotte Butterfield is an author of uplifting women's fiction, and her latest book, The Sister Switch, is out now and also in the RNIB library. Morning TV's favourite twin sisters, Alice and Edie, may share the screen, but that's where their similarities end. Their viewpoints are far from identical, and whilst their on-air clashes keep viewers hooked, off-camera their relationship is far from picture-perfect. After a heated argument on live television threatens their jobs, the fiery duo make a bet. Neither could last a week in the other's shoes. Determined to prove each other wrong, they secretly swap lives, without telling a soul. What starts as a battle of wills quickly spirals into chaos, as each sister discovers that the other's life is far more complicated than it seems. Between dodging awkward work situations, marital issues, and meddling in each other's families, Alice and Edie's rivalry turns from a competitive bet into an opportunity to help change each other's lives for the better. But will their relationship survive? The audio version of The Sister Switch is read by Claire Willey.
Alice and Edie. Sisters were meant to share everything, but the only thing Alice and Edie shared were their faces. Finding identical twin sisters with such opposing views, one a qualified relationship therapist and one with an Instagram following most reality stars tried to manifest every sunrise, was television gold. And as for Alice and Edie, well, they couldn't believe their good fortune. They were now being paid to do what they'd spent the last 45 years doing for free. Bicker. Welcome back to Britain in the Morning. Lauren, the co-host, smiled brightly into camera three. And we're joined on the sofa by our resident agony aunts, sisters Alice and Edie. At the mention of their names, both sisters smiled brightly down the camera lens, while tilting their heads ever so slightly to the left, the way the producer had told them to, just to hammer home the whole shared womb creation story of the two women. They're here to help you with some of your festive problems, Lauren continued. And golly, our inboxes have been heaving under the weight of the nation's worries. The first conundrum of the day comes from Janet in Yorkshire, whose three children are all in their late teens and early 20s and have all asked if they can bring their new partners to Christmas. She and her husband were looking forward to a Christmas just the five of them and are now worried about the change in dynamics. What advice would you give to her?
It's about these two identical twins, Alice and Edie, and their morning TV agony aunts. They are incredibly different in their personality, but they're identical in what they look like. And they've never really got on. As their relationship hits crisis point, they make a bet to swap lives for a week to literally see how the other half lives. They don't tell their husbands, their kids, or the TV viewers. So it's basically like Parent Trap, but for grown-ups.
The best investment I have made is a basket of house slippers just inside the front door, where all guests exchange their shoes for fur-lined moccasins as soon as they walk in. It immediately makes everyone more relaxed, as they are extraordinarily comfy, and it saves your carpet as well. Incidentally, I also double up on the number of coasters at Christmas time, so each occasional table has at least four. Oh, great tips there, Lauren said, nodding along. Edie, anything to add? Edie smiled sweetly. No, not really. Alice has nailed it there. The look of confusion on the co-hosts' faces was nothing compared to the bewilderment on Alice's. Edie had never agreed with her on any topic. Apart from saying, Edie added, that the canaries are really lovely this time of year, and the thing that would keep your new stair runner really looking pristine is an empty house. Well, we've got to break for the news now, Lauren said quickly, but remember to keep your questions coming in for the new year when the sisters will be back to answer more of your dilemmas. Stay tuned for our pick of the best sequin jumpsuits for all your party needs. Molly in Llandudno, this one's for you.
When you were writing it, between Alice and Edie, did you end up having a favourite?
Well, friends of mine tell me that they've sort of challenged me to try and write a novel which is not autobiographical. So the character Edie is much more me. My house is very much not as organised as Alice's is. The contents of my fridge are not categorised by self by date or by genre. So yes, Edie is definitely more my spirit animal than Alice. I've got two sisters, and so it was, I think they both see bits of them in Alice as well. They're much tidier than I am.
That's what I was going to ask, if you had sister siblings and if the bickering was based in real life.
Oh, absolutely. I think anyone with sisters would sort of say that's part and parcel of growing up with your best friends. I'm very lucky. I'm the eldest of three girls, and we do get on extremely well, but we are incredibly different, which is also a topic that I love kind of researching, of how two, you know, people with the same sort of parents and the same pretty much DNA can come out so different, you know, in their outlook and their behaviour and personality. So it's sort of a topic I delve into in most of my books, actually.
I think most readers will have a favourite husband or partner. Well, Seb.
But,
how did you go about writing Danny?
Oh, that's quite interesting. And he's absolutely not, for the record, set on any of my brother-in-laws or my own husband. I also didn't want him to be two-dimensional, you know, a sort of gruff Scotsman. But you can see how... I was actually at a football match. My family are very avid Arsenal fans. I sort of sit on the periphery of that. But I was at a football match and everyone was chanting this player's name. And I just thought, crikey, what must that do to you, you know, in the future when that stops, when you're not walking into a stadium and or not walking into a supermarket and everyone's, you know, chanting your name? That must be such a difficult thing to then come to terms with. So that sort of was at the heart of creating this quite unlikable husband, Danny, of, you know, he's left professional rugby and he used to play for Scotland. And, you know, and I think that is a line in the book of, you know, he's indicative of what happens when a stadium stops shouting for you. So, yeah, I think that was sort of my motivation of trying to get inside his head. And it must be really difficult when you've got that level of fame and then it immediately stops.
And on behalf of my friends, what have you got against Fife?
Do you know what? I did think that when I was writing it. I was so rude about Fife. And then I thought, oh, I've actually been there and it's lovely. So I don't know why I picked that out of a hat. I do apologise for anyone that's listening in Fife.
Now, they start off as agony ants on the TV. So what was the actual spark that ignited this whole story?
To be honest, it started off a smaller story. So it started off just sort of two ordinary, you know, wives and mothers who don't have the fame element to them as well. But then I thought, you know, it's one thing tricking your husbands and then your kids. But what if you're actually trying to trick millions of viewers? And, you know, and also, you know, I love writing comedy. And I thought that has kind of comedy gold written all over it when they are on the sofa on the morning television, trying to kind of be each other, but also sort of parodies of each other. You know, I think if you sort of say to any of your siblings or your friends, like, oh, try and impersonate me, they'd be kind of quite over the top with their impersonation, wouldn't they? So this is what the sisters do when they're actually being each other on the TV. They kind of are too much the other one. And that's, yes, that hopefully is sort of quite comedic.
Edie was probably the only person in the world that had ever witnessed Alice's transformation from human into beast firsthand. It was a rare but dramatic phenomenon that only happened once every few years and encompassed a full body stiffening, a sharp intake of oxygen, followed by a long exhalation of flames. She's 10 years old, Alice said from between her teeth. Yes, Edie replied. And? 10-year-olds don't just decide to be vegan. Iris has. There was more than a hint of pride to Edie's voice at the emergence of her young daughter's social conscience. Alice put her hands on her hips. Well, tell her she can't be. I'm not telling her that. Her beliefs are perfectly valid. Alice's voice moved up an octave. No, they're not. She's 10. If it's that much of a problem, she'll just have the roast potatoes and vegetables. I'm cooking the potatoes in goose fat. Can't you use vegetable oil? Alice put her hand on her chest as though to soothe the onset of a coronary. Do you even know what you're asking? I don't know why you're overreacting. She'd be happy with pasta. Pasta? Pasta?
More from my chat with Charlotte Butterfield after we visit the RNIB Library to find some brand new books. After this.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. What happens in the Talking Book Studios when the narrator makes a mistake?
What the engineer used to have to do is stop the tape, wind the tape back a little bit, listen to a place where we could slot the reader back in again, tell the reader where we wanted them to start, play the tape, and at the same time as putting a cue light on, we used to put the player into record, therefore rubbing out the mistake and recording the whole thing correctly. So what we're left with is a tape which was 2 hours long, one side of tape was 2 hours, without any mistakes whatsoever. Most speech studios will come along and edit all the books afterwards, but in the way we did it, we were able to say right at the end of the book, that's it, we haven't got any more work to do, and it was a perfect finish.
And I've been reading for RNIB, blah, blah. How's that? Does that work?
The new digital Bokingtuk?
Bokingtuk, yeah. It's Bokingtuk. A new word.
I enjoyed doing this sort of thing for its own sake, and if
damn. Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood. Brand new books available now from RNIB Libraries.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. A Piece of Work, Playing Shakespeare and Other Stories by Simon Russell Beale was given to us by Littlebrow.
When I was 8, I was sent away to a boarding school in the centre of London. My father, an army doctor, had just been posted to Singapore. Needless to say, this was a very exciting prospect, although, frankly, the excitement felt rather familiar. We were already, even at this early stage, a well-travelled family. I was born in Malaysia, my twin brothers in Hong Kong. We'd recently spent a short time on the coast of Libya. Nowhere, even the UK, felt quite like home. Just before moving to Singapore, we were quartered in a surprisingly large and very ugly flat overlooking the River Thames. It felt grand to be living next to the Tate Gallery and within walking distance of Westminster Abbey and the Houses of Parliament, but of course it was a temporary arrangement. We were no more than visitors, even like other army families, vagabonds.
Simon Russell Beale is one of Britain's most recognisable and well-loved actors. He's played many roles on stage, film, television and radio, ranging from Winston Churchill to Stalin, George Smiley to King Arthur. But ever since his appearance at school as a glamorous Desdemona, complete with false eyelashes that rendered him half-blind, he's been captivated by Shakespeare.
In a piece of work, Russell Beale tries to get under the skin of the playwright and find out what interested him. Was Shakespeare an instinctive conservative, or rather gently subversive? How collaborative was he? Did he suffer from insomnia and experience sexual jealousy? Russell Beale describes what it is to approach and live with some of Shakespeare's most famous characters. Some of the actor's inspiration comes from surprising sources. Watching Coronation Street gave him an idea about how Richard III might react upon hearing the death of the two princes in the Tower. A visit to elderly patients in a local hospital gave him insights into King Lear's descent into madness. And the memory of a childhood holiday led him into a spectacular plunge into an ornamental pool in Much Ado About Nothing. A Piece of Work is a brilliant account of an actor's life and work and his relationship with our foremost dramatist.
The scrapbook contains a picture of the boat that carried my family to Singapore. To my adult eyes, it looks tiny and rather frail, but it obviously did its job well enough. My mother and siblings arrived safely in their new home, greeted by my father, who was waiting for them on the quayside. In my child's mind, I travelled along with them. That was one of Grandma's skills, the skill of a teacher, I suppose. In that small house, heated intermittently with coal fires, squatting by the mud-choked River Usk, she conjured up for me visions of the spice markets of Sri Lanka and the rubber plantations of Malaysia, the deafening noise of Bombay and the empty expanse of South Africa. She told me, to my delight, that a writer had once described my birthplace, the island of Penang, as the Pearl of the Orient. The ship stopped there before the last leg of her voyage. I celebrated Christmas that year in Wales, and marked too my 8th birthday, which followed soon after. One memorable treat during that festive period was a visit to the local amateur dramatic society to watch my cousin Anne play a leading role in Our Town by Thornton Wilder. I thought she was beautiful, and the play itself, surprisingly perhaps for a family that didn't go to the theatre regularly, was mesmerising. I was still rather a novice when it came to live performance. My piano teacher, an elderly lady called Mrs. Ritchie, who lived in a tiny flat in Pimlico, London, with her equally musical daughter Connie, had taken me a year before to a performance of Don Giovanni at the Colosseum. I found it tough. Mozart operas, beautiful though they are, do go on a bit, and while I was thrilled by Mrs. Ritchie's kindness, I was a little bored. I was more excited by the delicious tomato sandwiches she made. The tomatoes were sprinkled with lemon and sugar, an unbeatable combination.
A Piece of Work, playing Shakespeare and Other Stories by Simon Beale, runs for 11 hours and 51 minutes and is read by the author.
Marble Hall Murders by Anthony Horowitz is the latest in the Magpie Murders series, which have recently been on TV. It was given to us by Penguin Random House.
Alan Conway didn't enjoy writing murder mysteries, so he amused himself by playing games with his readers. He hid things in his books, puzzles within puzzles. The mention of Lady Chalfont had reminded me that for no good reason, all the characters in Gin and Cyanide were named after London Underground stations. Lady Chalfont herself had come from Chalfont and Latimer on the Metropolitan line, and there had also been a butler called Hillingdon, Adam and Artemis Perivale, two socialites, and a detective inspector Stockwell. I was surprised he hadn't thrown in Lord Edgware for good measure.
Susan Ryland has had enough of murder. She's edited two novels about the famous detective Atticus Punt, and both times she's come close to being killed. Now she's back in England, and she's been persuaded to work on a third. The new continuation novel is by Elliot Crace, grandson of Miriam Crace, who was the biggest-selling children's author in the world until her death exactly 20 years ago. Elliot believes that Miriam was deliberately poisoned, and when he tells Susan that he's hidden the identity of Miriam's killer inside his book, Susan knows she's in trouble once again. As Susan works on Punt's last case, a story set in an exotic villa in the south of France, She uncovers more and more parallels between the past and the present, the fictional and the real world, until suddenly she finds that she has become a target herself. It seems that someone in Elliot's family doesn't want the book to be written, and they will do anything to prevent it.
And then there were the word games. The acrostics, the anagrams, the cryptograms, the codes. These had the effect of deconstructing the books so that instead of focusing your attention on the characters and the plot, you were invited to consider the very building blocks he used, the letters on the page. This was one of the reasons why my time as Alan's editor was so difficult. I might ask him to take out an extraneous detail or reorganize a sentence because it didn't land comfortably on the ear, and he would explode in anger. Over time, I came to realize that there were secrets in the books, and although no reader would ever be aware of them, I was spoiling his fun. Charles Clover, the CEO of Cloverleaf Books and the editor of Alan's last four books, had first-hand experience of this when he was publishing Magpie Murders. The two of them were having dinner at the Ivy Restaurant when Charles referred to Alan's latest novel as The Magpie Murders. Alan had hit the roof. The title was Magpie Murders, he yelled. There was no the involved. It was only later that we discovered the titles of all nine Atticus Pund novels had been deliberately chosen so the first letters would form an acrostic. Atticus Pund Investigates, No Rest for the Wicked, Atticus Pund Takes the Case, Night Comes Calling, and so on. What they spelled out was an anagram. Not an anagram.
Marble Hall Murders by Anthony Horowitz runs for 17 hours and 40 minutes and is read by Leslie Manville and Tim McMullen.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer. I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 25 years now. My first book was Coming From Behind by Howard Jacobson, but the one I think I enjoyed most was Writing Home by Alan Bennett. Not just because it's wonderful writing, but although not officially an autobiography, you've got a sense of his life as all his selections of writings were put in chronological order. I particularly like The Lady in the Van. The Talking Book studios, as now, were very close to where Alan Bennett lived, and I was able to walk up and actually see the driveway in the house in which the lady lived for 25 years. And quite by chance, Alan Bennett was sitting on his front step reading The Guardian when I turned up.
This van, there were to be three others in the course of the next 20 years, was originally brown. But by the time it had reached the Crescent, it had been given a coat of yellow. Miss S. was fond of yellow. It's the papal colour. And was never content to leave her vehicles long in their original trim. Sooner or later she could be seen moving slowly round her immobile home, thoughtfully touching up the rust from a tiny tin of primrose paint, looking, in her long dress and sun hat, much as Vanessa Bell would have looked had she gone in for painting Bedford vans. Miss S. never appreciated the difference between car enamel and ordinary gloss paint, and even this she never bothered to mix. The result was that all her vehicles ended up looking as if they'd been given a coat of badly made custard or plastered with scrambled egg. Still, there were few occasions on which one saw Miss Shepherd genuinely happy, and one of them was when she was putting paint on.
I love doing the talking books because, well, you get to play parts that you'd never get to play in real life. In fact, doing a book is a bit like doing a one-man show, only one that's 25 hours long.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now on Read On, I return to my chat with author Charlotte Butterfield.
Now, we've heard clips of the book, and in the past your books have had a variety of narrators, and sometimes two narrators.
Now, there's two characters in this one, but the single narrator here emphasised the fact that they were identical twins.
Yes, this was an I am in absolute awe of Claire Willey that did the audio. I must say as well, choosing the audio narrator is probably my favourite part of the book writing process. You know, I absolutely love it when the email comes in from my editor saying, here are the samples. And for this one, they sent me about 8 samples. And, you know, as an author, I've lived with these characters for the 6 or 8 months that it's taken me to write the book, you know, and I know so much about them. You know, I know that if they're in a supermarket, what they'd have in their trolleys or what they keep in their pockets. You know, I know them so well that it's quite an instinctive thing that when I press play on the sample, I know within 5 seconds whether it's the voice that I've heard in my head for 8 months. You know what I mean? And so when I heard Claire's, instantly, I was like, yeah, you absolutely nailed the sisters. But the interesting thing is that not only did she have to try and find quite unique, distinctive voices for Alice and Edie, but she also then needed to do Alice as Alice, Alice as Edie, Edie as Edie, and Edie as Alice, you know, and then throw into the mix this gruff Scotsman from Fife as a husband. So it was absolutely no small task at all, and she absolutely nailed it all. I'm in awe of her.
Do you ever fancy narrating any of your books yourself?
I would, but after hearing what a fantastic job Claire has done, I absolutely would not be up to that challenge. I would love to, and I love it when I listen to books that authors, you know, particularly sort of, you know, famous authors, and you can hear their voice, their personality shines through. But I think I would have to leave it up to the professionals to do accents and that type of thing. I'm not sure I'm quite up to that. But my friends who read the book in print or digital say that when they're reading, they can always sort of hear my voice narrating it to them as they're reading, which I quite like. So basically, I'm a pseudo audio narrator in people's heads, not in real life.
Are you actually saying the dialogue out loud as you're writing it to help the writing process?
I do sometimes to sort of see the pacing as well. And because, you know, because my books do have comedic elements in them, I think comic timing is quite important as well. And to sort of, so I will, I've treated myself last year to a writing shed, and I'm not using any other words to describe it to make it more glamorous, because it literally is a shed. I sort of squirrel myself away in there so I can talk to myself to my heart's content. So yes, I do say quite a lot of things out loud.
Now, you say you've now got a writing shed. How did you actually get a start as a writer?
So I've always been a professional writer. So I did an English degree straight out of university, and then I did a master's in women's studies. But to fund my university, I always wrote for local magazines. So I did kind of restaurant reviews or local concert reviews, that type of thing. And then straight out of university, I got a job, £75 a week, at Venue magazine in Bristol, which was part of the Bristol Evening Post back then. We're sort of talking like late 90s, early 2000s. And so I worked for them as a sort of junior feature writer for a first few years. And then I moved to Dubai to become a features editor in a magazine. And I worked myself up to be editor of women's lifestyle titles. So I've always sort of been a journalist, you know, a writer. And then it was about 8 years ago, I was on maternity leave with my last son. And I just thought, you know what, I'm going to see if I can write a novel, which is what I think a lot of journalists think they've got one in them. But I didn't tell anyone, just in case it turned out I really didn't have one in me. And so I wrote this novel, and I very quietly self-published it, because I just didn't have the confidence to send it out and get the, you know, all the rejections that you hear about. So I self-published it, and then with a kind of buoyed up by, you know, some friends saying, you know what, this is good, I entered it for a competition at a writing festival, a literature festival in Dubai, and I came second. And it was that sort of changed my life, really. One of the judges was Luigi Bonomi, a brilliant London literary agent. And the prize was lunch with him. And so over lunch, I sort of pitched my whole novel, because you only send in like your first 5,000 words. And he signed me and then got me my first book deal with HarperCollins, which was, 7 books ago. So I'm absolutely, stroke of fate and huge amounts of luck.
Never in the history of the English or Italian language had the word pasta been said with such an intense disdain, except perhaps at a Quito convention. Look, Edie replied, holding her hands up in a conciliatory way, I can bring a packed lunch for her. Packed lunch? Packed lunch? Why are you repeating everything twice? Alice flapped her hand in the air. We might as well just call it all off. Well, that seems an entirely logical and proportionate response to learning about your niece's dietary requirement. It's not a dietary requirement. It's a ridiculous fad that you are absolutely idiotic for entertaining. Alice turned her back on her sister and held onto the roof of her car with both hands, breathing in through her nose for three and out for three. In for three, out for three.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I do, absolutely, yes. So I do in the car and I do with my dog walks and, yeah, I'm a big fan of audiobooks.
And now the Sister Switch and your previous books are all available in audio. It means that anyone can access them, whether they're dyslexic, they've got sight loss, but they don't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Oh, it massively is. My godmother has lost her sight through MS. And it was always one of my things that when I wrote my novels and she was like, oh, I'm so sad I won't be able to read them. And my first three weren't in audio. And so her daughter used to go over and read them out to her. And then so when then my next novels were then in Audible, she was my first Audible download each time. And so I'm absolutely thrilled. And she'll always give me feedback on like, do you know what, I like that narrator, but I didn't like the accent they did for this. Or, you know, so she's kind of, so she gives me really good feedback. But no, so that was really important. That's not just for her, obviously, but to be able to, all readers, to be able to hopefully read the stories.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the audiobook from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of The Sister Switch?
Yes, of course. There's a hugely talented designer at Avon, who I'm published by at HarperCollins, and she's done quite a few of my last covers. And this one it's so vibrant because it's depicting the two sisters' lives. It's split halfway vertically down the middle, and one side is blue and one side is orange. And then it's got the two sisters in an illustration back to back. And Edie has sort of combat trousers on, is barefoot with a little tattoo on her arm that I did not put in the book, but I like the designer having that touch to it. But her hair is loose and flowing and she's got sort of big bangles on, very much like what I'm wearing today, actually. And whereas Alice is, you know, back to her and there's a lot more put together. So she's got heels on and a pencil skirt and, you know, looks like she's probably ironed her clothes and her hair is quite neatly tied back. And so it's very obviously their personalities. So it's got the Sister Switch in this lovely sort of quite nostalgic font, you know, sort of old Hollywood type thing. And then it's got two author quotes, one by the author Amanda Prowse and the other by the author Holly Miller, who did The Sight of You. So I was so grateful to them for quoting for my cover. And it's got the tagline, two twins, one bet, a lifetime of secrets.
You seem a little wound up. Would you like an armchair? A bottle of Bailey's and a straw? When Alice eventually spoke, every syllable was sounded out. Do you have any idea how many hours I have put in to making this Christmas perfect? No, you don't, because you've never hosted one. You're only too happy to leave your hovel of a house for a few hours' respite, eat my food, drink my drink. Wear your slippers, Edie said cheerfully, knowing full well the impact of every one of her words on her sister. Speaking of which, have you noticed that set number three have been missing since last Christmas? I stole them. You're right, they are extraordinarily comfy. You won't approve, but I also wear them outside to take the bins out. I can't even... Alice choked out, her knuckles turning white with the strength of her grip on the car's roof rack. 11:30 Christmas Day, he said. See you then. We'll try not to be late. Don't worry, I'll bring my own moccasins.
another cup of clear Willie reading from The Sister Switch by my guest Charlotte Butterfield, available in print as an ebook and in audio. And Charlotte, thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Thank you so much for having me on.
And we'll get some book recommendations from Charlotte at the end of today's show in Books of My Life. But for now, let's head back into the RNIB library to find some brand new audiobooks.
Hiroshima by John Hersey was donated by Penguin Random House.
At exactly 15 minutes past 8 in the morning, on August 6, 1945, Japanese time, at the moment when the atomic bomb flashed above Hiroshima, Miss Toshiko Sasaki, a clerk in the personnel department of the East Asia Tin Works, had just sat down at her place in the plant office and was turning her head to speak to the girl at the next desk. At that same moment, Dr. Masakuzu Fuji was settling down cross-legged to read the Osaka Asahi on the porch of his private hospital overhanging one of the seven deltaic rivers which divide Hiroshima. Mrs. Hatsuyo Nakamura, a tailor's widow, stood by the window of her kitchen watching a neighbor tearing down his house because it lay in the path of an air raid defense fire lane. Father Wilhelm Kleinsorge, a German priest of the Society of Jesus, reclined in his underwear on a cot on the top floor of his order's three-story mission house, reading a Jesuit magazine, Stimmen der Zeit. Dr. Terufumi Sasaki, a young member of the surgical staff of the city's large modern Red Cross hospital, walked along one of the hospital corridors with a blood specimen for a Wasserman test in his hand. And the Reverend Mr. Kiyoshi Tanimoto, pastor of the Hiroshima Methodist Church, paused at the door of a rich man's house in Koi, the city's western suburb, and prepared to unload a handcart full of things he had evacuated from town in fear of the massive B-29 raid, which everyone expected Hiroshima to suffer. 100,000 people were killed by the atomic bomb, and these six were among the survivors. They still wonder why they lived when so many others died. Each of them counts many small items of chance or volition, a step taken in time, a decision to go indoors, catching one streetcar instead of the next, that spared him. And now each knows that in the act of survival, he lived a dozen lives and saw more death than he ever thought he would see. At the time, none of them knew anything.
When the first atomic bomb was dropped in Hiroshima in August 1945, killing 100,000 men, women and children, it was the beginning of a terrifying new episode in human history. Written only a year after the disaster, John Hersey brought the event vividly alive with his heart-rending account of six men and women who survived despite all the odds. He added a further chapter when, 40 years later, he returned to Hiroshima to discover how the six same people had struggled to cope with catastrophe and with often crippling disease. The result is a devastating picture of the long-term effects of one very small bomb.
The Reverend Mr. Tanimoto got up at 5 o'clock that morning. He was alone in the parsonage, because for some time his wife had been commuting with their year-old baby to spend nights with a friend in Ushida, a suburb to the north. Of all the important cities of Japan, only two, Kyoto and Hiroshima, had not been visited in strength by the B-san, or Mr. B, as the Japanese, with a mixture of respect and unhappy familiarity, called the B-29. And Mr. Tanimoto, like all his neighbors and friends, was almost sick with anxiety. He had heard uncomfortably detailed accounts of mass raids on Kure, Iwakuni, Tokuyama, and other nearby towns. He was sure Hiroshima's turn would come soon. He had slept badly the night before because there had been several air raid warnings. Hiroshima had been getting such warnings almost every night for weeks, for at that time the B-29s were using Lake Biwa, northeast of Hiroshima, as a rendezvous point, and no matter what city the Americans planned to hit, the superfortresses streamed in over the coast near Hiroshima. The frequency of the warnings and the continued abstinence of Mr. B with respect to Hiroshima had made its citizens jittery. A rumour was going around that the Americans were saving something special for the city.
Hiroshima by John Hersey is read by George Guidall and runs for 5 hours and 24 minutes.
Traitor's Legacy by S.J. Paris was donated by HarperCollins.
Thrust, Intius, counter-parry, riposte, Intius, over the arm, engage, attack, advance, retreat, circular parry in second, disengage. Lunge in quart, riposte, good. Again. The clash of foils and the quick breathing of the combatants is the only sound in the gallery. Candles have been lit against the scant midday light, casting an amber glow over the wood panelling and tapestries of hunting scenes. The fencing master faints, engages, but hesitates imperceptibly, less than the space between heartbeats, as a bead of sweat trickles into his eye. His pupil spots the opening and seizes on it, lunging forward over the arm too fast for the fencing master, who finds himself backed up with the point of a foil at his throat.
"A palpable hit," he concedes, glad of the chance for respite.
"Consider yourself dead." His pupil's expression is unreadable behind the thin leather mask. Only a pair of bright, tawny eyes are visible, missing nothing.
England, 1598. Queen Elizabeth's successor remains unnamed. The country teeters on a knife edge. When a young heiress is found murdered at the theatre, the Queen's spymaster, Robert Cecil, calls upon former agent Sophia de Wolfe to investigate. A cryptic note found on the dead girl's body connects to Sophia's previous life as a spy, and her quest soon takes her into dangerous waters. Powerful enemies emerge, among them the Earl of Essex, the Queen's favourite courtier and a man of ruthless ambition. This is a murder that reaches directly into the heart of the court, and Sophia is concealing a deep buried secret of her own. She must uncover the truth before her past threatens to destroy her.
"Will we rest a moment?" the master asks hopefully. "If you need to. I'll send for something to drink." His pupil unties the ribbons holding the mask in place and shakes loose a cascade of chestnut hair, briefly releasing a scent of rose water into the close air, before catching the locks and winding them into a coil which she secures with a comb at the back of her head. Her face is flushed with the exertion and the triumph of winning a bout, making her seem younger than her 35 years. The fencing master, who is 10 years older, wonders how much longer he will be able to keep up with her. She lays her foil in its case, crosses the gallery, and takes a linen cloth proffered by the young maid, who waits unobtrusively in a window embrasure, ostensibly to fetch and carry, but also for the sake of propriety. Not that this is something Sophia de Wolfe cares about overmuch, but her steward insists on it.
Traitor's Legacy by S.G. Paris is narrated by Kristin Atherton and runs for 11 hours and 39 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show, with Robert Kirkwood.
A gift in your will is a really special way to continue supporting RNIB. Large or small, all gifts can have a huge impact on our services, as our work is vital and our services are needed more than ever. Over a third of the work we do is funded by the generosity of supporters who leave a gift in their will to RNIB. If you leave a legacy, you will make a significant difference to the lives of blind and partially sighted people, so their future is full of opportunity. Creating a will offers you the chance to make sure the people and causes you care about most are supported for years to come. We've made it easier for you to write or update your will with our free, accessible and simple will writing services. To find out more, please call 0303 123 9999 or go to rnib.org.uk/legacy.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and The pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports talking books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. And finally, on today's show, a return to author Charlotte Butterfield for Books of My Life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh, absolutely. I have so much love for The Magic Faraway Tree by Enid Blyton. I'm something of a nomad at heart. You know, I've lived abroad quite a lot of my life. And even as a child, the idea of being able to go outside your house, climb up a ladder and escape into a different land whenever you wanted massively appealed to me. So I absolutely love that. And I remember reading it to I've got three children, reading it to them when they were little. And my daughter, who's now 17, when I finished reading it to her for the very first time, she would have been maybe 6 or 7, she started crying afterwards. And I said, "Why are you crying?" And she said, "Because I don't want it to end. And now I know that I'll never be able to read it again for the first time." And I just thought, oh my goodness, what a terrible thing to say. And I think, you know, I've definitely felt like that with books, that when they end, you don't want them to end because you're enjoying it so much. So I loved that my children have the same love for that book that I do.
"What is topsy-turvy land like?" asked Joe, taking another pop cake. "Never been there," said Moonface. "But I should think it's quite safe, really. It's only just come there, so it should stay for a while. We could go up and see what it's like and come down again if we don't like it. Silky, Saucepan, and I will come with you if you like." Moonface turned to the Saucepan Man, who was enjoying his fifth pop cake. "Saucepan, we're going up the ladder," he said. "Are you coming?" "Humming?" said Saucepan, looking all round as if he thought there might be bees about. "No, I didn't hear any humming." "I said, are you coming?" said Moonface. "Oh, coming," said Saucepan. "Of course I'm coming. Are we going to take our lunch?" "Yes," said Moonface, going to a curved door that opened onto a tiny cupboard. "I'll see what I've got. Tomatoes, plums, ginger snaps, lemonade. I'll bring them all." He put them into a basket. Then they all went out of the funny curved room on the big branch outside. Moonface shut his door. Joe led the way up to the very top of the faraway tree. Then suddenly, Rick gave a shout of astonishment. "Look!" he cried. "There's an enormous white cloud above and around us. Isn't it mysterious?" Sure enough, a huge white cloud floated above them. But just nearby was a hole right through the cloud. "That's where we go, up that hole," said Joe. "See that branch that goes up the hole? Come on." They all went up the last and topmost branch of the faraway tree. It went up and up through the purple hole in the cloud. At the very end of the branch was a little ladder. Joe climbed the ladder, and suddenly his head poked out into the land of topsy-turvy. Then one by one, all the others followed, and soon all 7 of them stood in the curious land.
That's Evelyn MacLean reading from The Magic Faraway Tree by Enid Blyton. Available from RNIB Talking Books. Is there a book on a rainy day that you could happily curl up with and reread?
I keep going back to, so many times, Tipping the Velvet by Sarah Waters. I absolutely love the journey that she takes us on with this main character, Nan, who you start seeing her at the very beginning. She is, you know, sort of 17, 18 years old as an oyster shucker in Whitstable, you know, in the back of an oyster shop, scrubbing till her hands are raw, these oysters every day. And then she ends up, twists and turns of life makes her end up then in a Victorian music hall as part of an act. And I absolutely love the, you know, this kind of life journey she takes us on, and the way that she describes the kind of whole music hall scene of the late Victorian period. And oh, it's just gorgeous. I must have read it about 20 times and I absolutely adore it.
Have you ever tasted a Whitstable oyster? If you have, you will remember it. Some quirk of the Kentish coastline makes Whitstable natives, as they are properly called, the largest and the juiciest, the savouriest yet the subtlest oysters in the whole of England. Whitstable oysters are, quite rightly, famous. The French, who are known for their sensitive palates, regularly cross the Channel for them. They are shipped in barrels of ice to the dining tables of Hamburg and Berlin. Why? The king himself, I heard, makes special trips to Whitstable with Mrs. Keppel to eat oyster suppers in a private hotel. And as for the old queen, she dined on a native a day, or so they say, till the day she died. Did you ever go to Whitstable and see the oyster parlours there? My father kept one. I was born in it. Do you recall a narrow, weather-boarded house painted a flaking blue, halfway between the High Street and the harbour? Do you remember the bulging sign that hung above the door that said that Astley's oysters, the best in Kent, were to be had within? Did you, perhaps, push at that door and step into the dim, low-ceilinged, fragrant room beyond it? Can you recall the tables with their checkered cloths, the bill of fare chalked on a board, the spirit lamps, the sweating slabs of butter? Were you served by a girl with a rosy cheek and a saucy manner and curls? That was my sister Alice. Or was it a man, rather tall and stooping, with a snowy apron falling from the knot in his necktie to the bow in his boots? That was my father. Did you see, as the kitchen door swung to and fro, a lady standing frowning into the clouds of steam that rose from a pan of bubbling oyster soup or a sizzling gridiron? That was my mother. And was there at her side a slender, white-faced, unremarkable-looking girl with the sleeves of her dress rolled up to her elbows and a lock of lank and colourless hair forever falling into her eye and her lips continually moving to the words of some street singer's or music hall song? That was me.
That's Charlotte Strevens reading from Tipping the Velvet by Sarah Waters, available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
Absolutely, and this is actually an audiobook as well. About 18 months ago, my father passed away and I was gifted a book called Loss by Donna Ashworth. And it really helped me, this book of poetry. I'd never come across her before and I adored it. And so since then, I've read everything that she's written. And her latest book, To the Women by Donna Ashworth, is incredible. And I listened to it on Audible and it's herself narrating it, and she's got this light Scottish burr that sort of envelops you in love, and every single poem I sort of felt like she'd crawled inside my brain and read my mind, and I absolutely adore it. And so I've gifted that to quite a few of my friends as well, but now it's on my Audible download. I'll quite often, probably a couple of times a week, just dip in for, you know, 15 minutes and listen to a few poems. Yes, it's absolutely glorious.
I self-published the original version of this book in 2020, the year the world locked down, and I had no idea at the time how it would change my life. The poems within came from a period of me seeking female connection, a sisterhood. I was floundering in my world, unsure of what I was doing, where I was going, and what I wanted out of my time here on this earth. Becoming a mother had slowed me down in a way, and allowed me to readjust my perspective enough to see that the rat race was no longer serving. I was tired. Tired of running too fast all the time and yet never seeming to be able to keep up. I knew instinctively that without one another, we women are not as centred and strong as we could be. We need to come together. We were always supposed to come together, for it's in the sharing of the secrets that the solutions lie. And this thread that bonds us stretches back through time and much adversity. I figured I would stand above the introverted parapet and wave a hand to see who came. And many, many of you came. Soon we were sharing and encouraging one another daily. Standing at the back of strangers online and finding solace in the knowledge that whatever you are facing, you are never alone. Someone else has faced it too. And the telling of their story can be the saving of yours.
That's Donna Ashworth reading from the introduction to To the Women, which is available commercially. In the RNIB library, we have I Wish I Knew by Donna Ashworth in Braille, and the three-volume collection Life, Love and Loss, Poems for Every Hurdle on Life's Highway, available in audio. And for an interview with Donna Ashworth on Read On, look for episode 378. And once again, Charlotte Butterfield, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Honestly, I've so enjoyed talking to you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.